Good evening. My name is Graham Rutherford. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome you to the Simple Actions Sober Living Mini Conference. This is our first one. Thanks for coming. And just to extend a warm welcome, come out here on Friday night. Hopefully everybody can get a seat. There's some gaps over there. So if you just try and filter in and get a seat. For those that would care to join me, let's have a moment of silence and we'll follow it with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. We wish to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. You can't smoke outside, just don't smoke inside and we're good. Our group is welcome on the first floor of this building. The restrooms are down here. There's one that says men on the door and there's one that says laddies on the door. So it's kind of confusing, but anyway. I'm confused. So the restrooms are right there, and we ask that once the meeting's underway, if you need to go to the restroom, please don't go out that door down there. Please just go up the back and you can walk down through the other room and do what you need to do. Take care of business. So anyway, we also respectfully ask that once the meeting's underway, please refrain from moving around the room as much as possible. The person sitting next to you may be listening to the speaker. Okay, anyway, the group statement. The Simple Actions group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I'll now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So as I said, please silence your cell phones. And we're going to, it looks like we've run out of coffee. I'm sorry. So we were going to cut it off during the meeting anyway. So it kind of worked out perfectly. Coffee will be available at the end of the meeting tonight. There's a free recording available of tonight's meeting, and if you can't make the workshops tomorrow, they'll all be on our website, which is simpleactions.net. And just click on audio at simpleactions.net, and Bob's talks tonight and tomorrow will all be on there free for you to download if you want to listen to them again. Hopefully, you'll want to listen to them again. Our home group meets on Monday nights at 7 o'clock at the church over the road. So, Bob, he came into town yesterday, and we went to a meeting and we hung out, and it was great. And I had to go to work today, but David didn't. He was off all day. So I've been spending all day thinking whether Bob likes David or me more. So that's what I'm bringing to the table tonight. But anyway, Bob carries a great message. That's why we brought him here. We hope you enjoy it. I'm not going to take up any more of his time. Bob D from Las Vegas.
You're assuming I liked either one of you. My name's Bob, and I am alcoholic. And only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. An ability to remain mostly sponsorable. And a persistent, consistent effort in the primary purpose of helping other alcoholics. I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion altering substance since October 31st, 1978. And that is and always will be the great miracle that has occurred in my life, because I'm one of those kind of guys that would swear to himself time and time again, after burning my life to the ground again, and I'm never going back to it, and I always did. I'd like to welcome all the people that are reasonably new. I'm just curious, not to embarrass you, but just to get an idea, how many people here in their first year of absolute abstinence? Wow, welcome, man. I'm glad you guys are here. First 30 days, anybody? Wow, yeah. Wow, welcome. Cool. Now the big question, last 30 days, anybody? Yeah, laugh. Just raise their hand. Okay. You will be gang 12-stepped at the end of the meeting, trust me. Because there's a lot of fanatic AA members in this room, I can tell. I want to tell you, because I believe in this. I was under misconception, which I function under misconceptions frequently. And the misconception is that this was going to be a big book workshop weekend. And consequently, when I talk at a workshop weekend, I don't put a coat and tie on. But if I come to a place to tell my story, I always wear a coat and tie. And I would have had one on tonight. Not because there is no requirement in AA for a guy like me to do that, but there's very little opportunity for me to demonstrate through my actions a respect for the thing that saved my life, and I try to take advantage of that. So I would have had a coat and tie on tonight if I had known that I was going to tell my story here. So I regret, you may not, it might be fine with you, but I regret that I don't have one on. I want to thank Graham and David for asking me to participate in this. And I'm surprised, I was thinking 15 people maybe would be here. I don't know why I'm alcoholic. I didn't want to be alcoholic. When it says in the beginning of the third chapter that most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics, man, I don't want to be alcoholic. I'll be a drug addict. There's a little panache in drug addiction. I mean, you know, the banner we used to march under was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, I'll be a drug addict. There's rock stars that are drug addicts. But alcoholic, it's kind of, there was a couple, I had some uncles that were alcoholic. They were pathetic. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I'll be a mental health case. There's nothing wrong with being, I mean, God, if you're a mental health case, they give you pills. I've never met a pill I wouldn't take a run at or didn't like to some degree. I'll be that, but I don't want to be an alcoholic. And you know something? It didn't change the fact that I was. And people who argue with the truth get sick. And over the next many years of denying and trying to prove to myself, the book says, through countless vain attempts, from every form of deception, self-deception, experimentation, switching from one thing to another, doing all the things that guys like me do because, for God's sakes, I don't want to be alcoholic. It didn't make any difference. I was, and I kept getting sicker and sicker, and I couldn't stop the progression of the disease. And I don't know why I ended up with alcoholism, because my mother and father weren't alcoholic. They were wonderful people. Man, they were very well-balanced, emotionally stable, kind, loving parents who dedicated their lives to their children and their community. And they were just remarkable people. Boring, but remarkable. I hung out with a guy whose dad was used to beat people up in the house and was in and out of prison. He was an outlaw motorcycle guy. Now, that's a guy. That's a father you could respect. But I was burdened by a childhood of love. And it's tough because you, if you're like me and you end up so screwed up, I'm so screwed up, and you go to meetings and you hear people talk about their terrible childhoods, you think, I just think enviously, God, if I had that childhood, there'd be a reason why I'm so messed up. But I think I was just born with a hunger, an unquenchable, unquenchable thirst that I never understood, and it just seemed to drive at me. It drove at me before I ever picked up a drink. There, I wasn't quite right. Even as a little kid, I remember going to grade school and things with my family and cousins and church stuff. And I never really felt like those people looked. You know, it just seemed to me that they had something. They had an ability to connect with each other and be a part of life. And I was always so separate and apart from. For some reason, I couldn't understand. Almost as if there was some invisible yet impenetrable barrier between me and life itself that I don't understand. It's just that I don't fit like they appear to fit. And I don't know why. And so I did what guys like me have done for hundreds, if not thousands of years. We pretend. We pretend we're okay. We pretend there's nothing wrong. I pretend I'm not afraid, and I'm afraid a lot. I pretend I'm cool, and I'm not cool. I pretend that I'm somebody that's okay, and I'm not. And when you're pretending and you're a phony and you're the guy talks about it into action, it says the alcoholic more than most creates a double life. I fine-tuned a facade that I would present to the world, and I would cower on the other side of it with this fear of being found out. You know, when I would act tough, I was always afraid somebody was going to realize I wasn't and come at me. When I acted cool, I was always afraid somebody was going to see through me and embarrass me. I walked with the anxiousness of being found out. When I was about 12 years old, not quite 13, I was hanging around with a bunch of older kids. And man, I wanted to fit with these kids. These were the tough kids. These were the kids that were always in trouble, that were in and out of the juvie facility. These were the kids, when they walked into a junior high dance, the other kids got out of the way. I mean, these kids had some kind of power, man. And when you're secretly the guy who's afraid, I don't want to be the guy who's afraid. I want to be the guy who's making people afraid. You know, that's looks like a better deal to me. And I wanted to fit with these guys, man. And I'm just, but I don't. When you're a phony and you're coming from behind, you can't do enough to feel like they look. It's never quite enough. And one day we pulled a burglary in the town I lived in, and we broke into this house, and I remember I'm a little wannabe gangster. I thought I was until the police explained that I was a public nuisance. I'm a little wannabe gangster, and we broke into this house, and they went right by the TV and stereo. I'm going, what, what? And they went right to the liquor cabinet. See, they knew something I didn't know. They knew where the power was, right? And I didn't know that because I didn't know anything about alcohol. I'd never seen my parents drunk. I'd never even seen anyone under the influence of alcohol, even though I'd seen someone have like one or two drinks in the course of an evening. But I didn't even know it got you high. I didn't know what it was about. And we stole some bottles of whiskey out of that house, and we were at the place where we usually hang out and smoke cigarettes and tell lies and do all that stuff we do. And we're passing around a quart bottle of Seagram 7. I can still remember the label. And I'm watching the other kids. Because when you're a phony, you got to watch people and see what they do and then try to emulate what they do when you're coming from behind. And I noticed that once one or two of the guys took a big hit off this bottle of whiskey, and they got a lot of attention from the other guys. So by the time it gets to me, I am in. I'm just glad it wasn't cat urine, because I'm in. I'm telling you. I'm signed up. And I took a big pull because I wanted their approval off that bottle. They don't tell you about the burning. Oh, my God. It was horrible. I thought it was eating my insides out. And somehow, I don't know how. I guess I was so afraid of embarrassment and what they'd think. Somehow, I kept it down. And after the burning stopped, something happened to me that would, unbeknownst to me, literally change the course of my life. And I started, for the first time in my life, I didn't have to pretend I was okay all right anymore. I really was. Whatever that thing was that was on me seemed to fall off of me. And I was a free man. And I could come out and play, and I could talk to people. I could laugh with the guys. I could be funny. When I got lit up in the early days of my drinking, it was spectacular. I mean, oh my God, it was such an amazing experience. I could get half lit up and shoot pool and get in that zone where you don't miss, man. It's just oh my God, I'm Willie Marsconi, Minnesota Fats, look out, man. I couldn't miss. I'd be just so on. I could play the guitar and sing in front of people. I can't do that sober because they're looking at me. I could talk to girls and dance. I can't do that sober. I could be funny. I mean, I could really be funny. I'd crack me up. I was funny when I was drinking. I could be creative. I could be thoughtful. I could be deep and philosophic. I remember one night, bunch of us sitting around drinking wine, smoking reefer, talking about the secrets of the universe, the real depth of life, you know. We're seeing the big picture. And I remember saying to these guys, this is what Buddha saw. It was almost like it expanded my consciousness. It was spiritual, kind of. I felt a connection. And alcohol, in the early days of my drinking, alcohol was the most immediate and spectacular medicine for something that was wrong with me that I didn't even recognize or understand, except without the effect of the alcohol, I ain't right. I don't know why I ain't right. See, I'm an alcoholic, and an alcoholic without alcohol, all that's left is the ick. And I got the ick. I remember one time, I was working in this factory. God, I hated those. I'd go to work hungover. I'd just hate those people. I'd hate my boss. I'd hate that factory. The people there are stupid. And everybody would walk on eggshells around me because I just put out those vibes, you know? Leave me alone. They would. I just can't stand it. That buzzer would ring for the end of that shift. I'd punch out and I'd bolt like an arrow across the street to this bar. I'd be the first one in there out of that shift, that factory. And I'd be in there, and the bartender knew what I wanted. I wanted those double shots, 100 proof. And I'd throw two double shots with beer in between, down. And by the time I've killed that second double shot, those idiots from that factory, some of them start coming in there. And as the second double shot of whiskey hits me, I start looking at them thinking, you know, they're really not bad people. You know, after a little while, I'd be shooting pool with a couple of the guys. And after about 7, 8, 10 drinks, man, we're planning our vacations together. You know? And I walked in there lonely and depressed and uptight, and I'm emotionally dying inside. And alcohol set me free. It took away the separation and the loneliness that my ego creates between me and people and me and life itself. And it set me free. I had no understanding or no conception that the problem really was is I was in the bondage of self. You see, as an alcoholic, when I stop drinking, I get sick. And it's a funny kind of sick. I can't put my finger on it. I can't explain it to you. I just, you know, Silkworth says it one way. He says we're restless, irritable, and discontent. And I'm all of that. I'm also, I suffer from low-level depressions, and this loneliness, man. In our book, there's a part, it says, towards the end, it talks about this jumping off place, and it says, we will know a loneliness such as few do. Alcoholism's a lonely business because I don't fit anywhere sober. And then there comes a time as the disease progresses where my experience with the medicine becomes as bad as my experience without it, even worse. And I didn't know I was in the grip of a progressive illness. The book says over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. I'm not saying it to scare you, but I'll tell you, it's the god-awful truth. If you're new here, and you came here maybe because you'd burnt your life to the ground, or maybe not completely to the ground, but you were on the verge of it, and things were bad, and you come here and now things are a little better and you feel a little better, if you pick up again, you won't pick up where you left off. I've watched this for decades. The disease progresses a little bit more and you get a little sicker and you end up coming off the next run. You hate yourself a little more and you're a little lonelier. And at the same time, is your very core seems to disintegrate into some sense of worthlessness. Your ego gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And you get to a point where nobody can help guys like me because you can't get through to me because I'm too full of myself. I become the I know guy. And that was the problem. See, I had people from the time I went to my first treatment center. I was about 19, maybe almost 20 years old. And I couldn't hear you. You can't help me. I'm too full of myself. I fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell him much. And my mother was a therapist. My mother worked for mental health in Pennsylvania. My father was very politically connected. He was a remarkable man, very respected by governors and a lot of people. Because of their connections, when I was in probably 20, 21, I started in my teens a little bit. But they, as things progressed and I got worse, my parents tried to help me. They spent a literal fortune on psychiatrists and treatment centers and fines and court costs and all kinds of stuff for me. And the more they helped me, the worse I got. And it must have drove them crazy. That it must have frustrated them on a level. They're watching their only son. He's just withering away and dying, and he's getting worse and worse, and they're doing everything they can to help me, and the more they try to help me, the worse I get. And they didn't know what was wrong with me, and I didn't either, and I went to some great therapists. Because I don't think AA, I'm exposed to a lot of AA, but I don't think AA has anything for me. And the reason I think that, and I'll tell you, I've run into a lot of people that have had this experience, is that I get physically sober, and I might have 2-3 months of abstinence, and I'm sitting in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in there. I'm going every day because I'm in a halfway house. They make you go every day, which I thought was cruel and unusual punishment. If you know what I mean. But I go every day, and I'm doing everything the people in AA appear to be doing. They're not drinking, they're going to meetings, and I'm doing all of that. And I listened to you and I watched you closely. And something became very apparent to me. This whatever is wrong with me is not the same thing that's wrong with you. Because you're not drinking and you're going to meetings and you're wonderful. You're grateful for everything. It just drives me crazy. I don't even like anything. I don't like me. And you guys are just, remember sitting in a halfway house? I said, bring these AA people in, put on a meeting there a couple times a week. My life is crap. I've just burned it to the ground again. And I just have to sit there and listen to the people from Alcoholics Anonymous come in and
tell their miracle stories. You know, just tell me how wonderful your life is, you know? And I remember sitting there at one point thinking, just, I could, like, if I hear one more person tell me how wonderful they am, my head's going to blow up. I thought, I've died and gone to hell. This is hell. This is hell. It's not bad enough. I've ruined my life. Now I got to hang around and have you rub my nose and how wonderful your life is. This is hell. I'm not like you when I quit drinking. Oh, and the people, they say weird things to you. Did you ever sit in a meeting with untreated alcoholism just with the ick and have people come up to you and say, has anyone told you they loved you? Oh, well, I do. I wouldn't say nothing because I don't like confrontation, but I just sit there and think, I hate you. And I'd like to know where you're living and when you're not going to be home. Maybe your life won't be so great when I'm done. And I used to go to meetings where everybody's throwing around these cliches and these slogans. Oh, my God. It's just, first things first. Let go and let God. Easy does it. Oh, it's just, I felt like I was being stoned by refrigerator magnets from a recovery bookstore. You know, just stop. And it doesn't mean anything. It's just these, stop, first things first. Well, what would you put first anyway? I mean, keep it simple. You got that one down pretty good. So I don't think there's anything here for me. But see, I don't know that I'm in the grip of a progressive disease that resides in self. That as time goes on, my ego, myself, whatever you want to call it, seems to get more dominant and more stronger. And I, you know, the ego is a treacherous mechanism. It has a greater survival mechanism than I do. It's one of its greatest tricks is to convince me it doesn't exist. I have never been in the middle of a plain God judgment fest, ego-driven, where in the middle of it I think, oh, this is ego. No, this is what it feels like to be right about you. I don't even know it's ego. I don't know. I don't see it. It's a devious shift changer. And I don't know what's wrong with me. There was a great psychiatrist who, he's also a rabbi, brilliant, brilliant scholarly man. He spent probably 50 years, at least 45 anyway, working with us. He's almost like the Dr. Silkworth of our age, I guess. And his name's Abe Torsky, and Abe worked at three different treatment centers. He lectured at three different places I end up, because I end up a lot of places. I just... And Abe, the third place, Abe was tired of seeing me, I guess, so he cornered me one time and he said to me, said, the reason that guys like you don't get any better and you'll probably, even though you'll probably relapse yourself to death over a couple years, is that even though you have no self-worth, and I didn't, I kind of loathed myself secretly, which makes perfect sense. If anyone would have done to my loved ones and family what I had done to them, I'd have killed them. So is it any wonder that you end up secretly loathing yourself? And he says that even though guys like you have no self-esteem and loathe yourself, you have such big egos that you can't listen to anyone in order to hear anything new. You can only listen to see how you are already right. Man, that was me. I am one who has all knowledge. And I know everything, and you can't tell me nothing, and I'm that guy. And I'm so defended, my ego is so defended, that anytime I'd be in an AA meeting, and a speaker or someone sharing starts to get a little bit close, says something, might be a little threatening to the defendedness of my ego just automatically has defense mechanisms that starts tearing you down.
automatically. I remember sitting in a meeting in a place called Gateway, and there was a speaker, Sunday afternoon, a speaker, and he started hitting some nerves because I was starting to, he's getting a little close because he's talking about some things that are my experience. And he's starting to get there. And I remember my head just automatically did this thing. It just like a little shift. It went, boy, that is a stupid looking toupee that guy's got. And it just discounted everything he said. Or I might find something wrong with the way you're dressed. Or I might think, oh my God, did you hear he's talking about God? He's a sunbeam for Jesus. Oh, you know, whatever. It doesn't, my ego doesn't care what it has to do to defend itself from the truth. It'll tear you down. It'll make fun of you. If I thank God I didn't get sober today, I would never be in a meeting. I'd sit there physically, but I'd be texting or playing video games or something, you know. I see that guys come in and they never, ever stay sober. They never stay sober because they're not here. They're doing a physical demonstration in their life like they don't want to be here, and consequently they don't get nothing here. And they'll come in and out of here 3 months out, 6 months out, 4 months out. And they never understand that if you come here and position yourself like a person would position themselves that doesn't really truly want this, that's what you're going to get. That's what you're going to get. In the beginning of chapter 5, it talks about guys like me. I was a relapser for over a half dozen years. Painful, painful years. It says those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Completely is like a lot. I mean, that's not just going to a meeting once in a while and trying not to drink. Completely is like the steps, the service, all three legacies. It seems a little fanatical to me. And so consequently, I couldn't do it because I can't give myself completely to anything except me. I'll give myself completely to me and my gratification and my prestige and what you think of me and my self-grandizement and my fun and my sex and my job and my finances. I'll completely give myself to me because I am my primary purpose. And did you ever watch the old timers in AA? Watch them. Watch how they live their life. It's almost like their primary purpose isn't really them. It's almost as if their primary purpose is serving some sort of ethic or principles that are hard to get your mind around. It almost looks like their primary purpose is really other people and helping others. And I didn't ever understood that. I wasn't against helping people. I mean, if I ever got my life together, I might help someone someday. But I'm me first, you know, I'm me first here. And I was dying. And I was in and out. I can't tell you how many times with everything in me, I just swear to myself and mean it, I'm never, ever touching that again. For God's sakes, I can't keep doing this. I'm homeless. I'm in and out of these shelters and these halfway houses. I feel horrible. All the fun's run out of it. It's not even a party anymore. It's turned on me. It's pathetic. I got guys I went to high school with that own homes and have businesses, and I was smarter than all of them. And I'm dying here. And I knew it. And I knew alcohol was killing me. I knew it. Alcohol and combinations of alcohol and drugs. I know. I'm not stupid. I get it. And I would swear to myself, I'd get my mind around that, and I'd swear to myself with every fiber of my existence, I'm never touching that stuff again. And something insidious would start to happen to me, and I can't describe it. I can't tell you about it. I can't even see it. But it starts the moment I enter into a state of abstinence, and it's a hideous thing. On a low level, right below the horizon, right below, right off my radar, some things start happening to me inside of me. And it's just a slow hideous, incremental gnawing away at this resolve that I'm never going to drink again. And it happens in vague little feelings that I can't put my finger on. I can't really tell you. I remember one time a counselor in a halfway house, I was sober maybe 6 months, and I was kind of depressed, and I, you know, I ain't doing that well. And he said to me, he says, "Bob, what's wrong?" And I remember just sitting there looking at him, thinking, "I don't know. I don't know. I wish I could tell you. Maybe you could help me. I wish I had something to pin this on. I don't know. It's not that anything's wrong. It's just that, for God's sakes, nothing's really right. I'm a fish out of water here. I don't know why I don't fit anywhere sober. I don't know why I feel so lonely, even in the middle of people that say they care about me. I don't know why I can't connect with you like I did. God, in the old days, man, I'd get lit up. I was a part of. I drink now, and it's hideous. I don't feel a part of anymore. And I get sober, and I ain't a part of either. And I'm lonely and pathetic when I'm drinking, and I'm lonely and pathetic when I'm not." But hope dies hard in us. I think a lot of alcoholics drink themselves to death because they will not give up hope. Now, that sounds like a weird thing to say. Aren't you supposed to have hope all the time? Aren't you always supposed to hang on to hope? Think positive? In a lot of life, that's true. But when it comes to alcoholism, if you continue to hope, what are you continuing to hope for? That you can beat this thing. And if you continue to hope that you can beat this thing, or that you can somehow, someday, some way, under the right set of circumstances, under the right combination of alcohol and medication, that I could jumpstart the party, take it back to the old days, as the book says, control and enjoy my drinking. See, as long as I had hope that I could do that, I ain't all the way in here, because I don't have to be all the way in here. I still got hope. As long as I had hope that a new town, a new girlfriend, getting that job in that steel mill, making that big bucks, that big own a house, have a boat, buy a Harley kind of money. As long as I have hope that something's going to fix me, I ain't a hopeless alcoholic. And the book says that we are alcoholics of the hopeless variety. The book, one of my favorite lines in there, it says, before you ever come to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous would ever work for a guy like me, before I ever came to believe in God, because I'm a little bit God-resistant. Well, he's got my job. I'm a little bit God-resistant. You know, I bet you I'm not the only one. Isn't it funny? How many people in this room had some sort of religious teaching or upgrade when you were a kid? Right? Okay. See, people like us, we rarely hear what the other kids heard. Because they're still going to that church and they think it's great. I didn't hear what they heard. I got the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I got a mind that seeks problems. And there's no problem with a God of love. But the idea that there's a God of judgment, now that's something I can worry about. I had this conception of God I got from as a little kid. Not all the kids heard this. I heard it. This is what I heard. That God existed to judge me. He could see in the dark. Oh, that's not good. Oh, no. I do my best work in the dark. That's not good. That's really hideous. And this one nun, I swear to God, she'd be looking at me. She'd say, "You must be pure of thought, word, and deed." And she'd tell us that God judged us for our thoughts. We didn't even have to do nothing. Just think about it. But she'd say, she was kind of a young nun. She'd say, "Pure of thought, word, deed." And my head, I didn't mean to, but I'd start imagining what she looked like naked under her habit. I think, "Oh, I'm going to hell now. This is, woo, woo." They don't even talk about that. This, oh my God, that's for the worst. They put the worst, that's the worst place in hell for somebody like that. I mean, he judged me for my thinking. That's a level of hideousness beyond anything I can imagine. Because I don't mean to have bad thoughts, but I'm not good at being good. I'm pretty bad at being good. I'm pretty good at being bad. I can think good, be good for a little while, and then it's like I outgood myself or something, and I gotta go the other way for a while. God judges me for my thinking. Well, primarily, for the most part, I have two movies that run in my head. One is sex, and the other is violence. I can be driving down to the street on a bad spiritual hair day today. I drive down the street. I'll kill him. Oh, I'll do her. I'll kill him. I'll do her. You know, and I'm racking up millions of years in purgatory, and I ain't even doing nothing. I'm just driving across town. I might be on my way to church. Who knows? Just racking up millions of years in purgatory. So, here's the kind of guy I am. I'm this way somewhat to this day. If I suspect, just suspect, I don't even need any evidence, my mind doesn't need evidence, it just has to suspect that you don't like me, I'm going to not like you first. So me, I did that with God, you know, because I don't feel like I'm going to measure up. So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys start talking about God. It's like, oh no, not that. But I, in moments of weakness, I at one time in a jail cell up in Maine, a guy who wants to be an atheist, that's really not. Isn't it funny from some of us we try to be atheists, and the minute we try to be an atheist, it's like some vacancy opens up and I start searching. I started searching. Buddhism, Hinduism, transcendental meditation, used to read all those Eastern, because it was different from, you know, I had all these prejudices about the way I grew up, so I started being searching. And I went in moments of weakness in this jail cell up in Maine, I got down on my knees and I begged God. I was there for something such a horrific thing. It was such a nightmare. I begged God, please, please. I did something that was horrible in a blackout. I almost killed I don't even know if he's going to live. He's in intensive care, my best friend. And I thought, please, God, don't ever, if there's a God, don't ever let me drink again. And I got drunk the day I got out. Right. I'd been to therapy. I'd been to church. I was hypnotized, regressed back into my childhood, even though I came from an apparently, from what I remembered, nice, loving family. I was suspect. I thought somebody must have done something to me. Well, you know, you kind of, when just sit and ponder yourself for about 20 minutes, you'll feel like someone's damaged me. Because I ain't right. I'm not right. You know, somebody must have done this to me. Maybe I was Miss Potty trained or something. I don't know. So I got regressed back in my childhood trying to figure out if there was something. Never figured out nothing. I primal screamed in a therapist's office one day. I'm embarrassed to tell you, at one point in this therapy, I laid on the floor of the therapist's office and screamed mommy, daddy at the top of my lungs as I kicked my hands and feet. It was embarrassing. I did gestalt therapy. I did rational motive therapy. I did transactional analysis. I tried a lot of things. I had some very kind POs work with me. I had some kind clergy work with me, some kind doctors, my family. And I'm not. I suspect if you're like me, by the time you get to AA, you probably have had a lot of experiences of people trying to help you. Because we are problematic people. And you know, it's weird. They all say different things, but they all say the same thing different ways, really. They all get in your face and they'll say things like maybe it's your minister, maybe it's your counselor, maybe it's your PO. Maybe you get really bad, all kinds of, even your drug dealer will start talking to you about what's wrong with you. And they all say the same thing pretty much. They always say, Bob, you were so screwed up. And you catch me on a bad day, and I'll go, yeah, I know. I know. They'll say, you know why you're screwed up? I don't know. I've been to all these therapists. They've been so many diagnoses. I don't know. And then they tell you, well, the reason you're so screwed up is you keep getting screwed up. If you didn't get so screwed up, you wouldn't be so screwed up. So I'm pretty screwed up. I think, okay, I am not going to get screwed up. And when I don't get screwed up, I get so screwed up, I got to go get screwed up. And I have no idea that alcoholism starts where the bottle ends. And the disease is progressing. The last couple years of my drinking were horrific. See, by this time I'd been through so many treatment centers, I finally understood that I had this disease. I knew it. I didn't want to be an alcoholic, but I knew it. I knew I couldn't have said the words phenomenon of craving or allergic reaction to alcohol because I'd never read the book. But I knew that I was the guy that when I started, it was letting something out of the cage that I couldn't get back in the cage. I always knew that. I really could not control this. I knew that I had that weird metabolism that once I started, I couldn't stop. And if you're a chronic alcoholic and you pick up a drink, it's like having sex with a gorilla. You ain't done till the gorilla's done. And you can tell yourself all night long, you know, me and that gorilla are just going to have a dance. No, you're not. No, it's not. It's going to be bad. It's really going to be bad. So I know that. I'm not stupid. I get it. Cause and effect. I've tried the countless attempts to try to control my drinking and failing. And I'm only going to go this far, and I always go farther. I get it. And the most horrific years of my life were after I knew that because of the spiritual malady. And I got so sick when I'm sober that I'd always go back to it again. And I don't mean to, but I always do. And my drinking is pathetic. It wouldn't have been bad if I went back to it and I had a couple hours of fun and then debauchery. But it's not fun anymore. I'd wrung all the fun out of it. The best part of every time I go out after a period of abstinence was the hour before it started. I'd have all that excitement and anticipation about how I'm going to mix it up, man. How I'm going to maybe play some music with some guys. I'm going to shoot some pool. I'm going to meet some girl. I'm going to. And I'd start drinking, and it was like this cloak of depression would just start settling in over me. And I would drink and feel sorry for myself. And from the moment I started drinking in the last couple years, I just stopped bathing because I don't care. My whole experience with alcohol the last few years cooked down to let's just blot Bob out. Let's drink for oblivion. And I was an oblivion drinker. And a lot of us end up that way because it's frantic. We become hopeless. We can't jumpstart the party and we don't have anything else, so we just try to blot it out. The book says there's but two alternatives. One is to go on to the bitter end, blotting out our intolerable situation as best we can, or to seek spiritual help. Spiritual help doesn't make any sense to sick people. And I tried, I thought. I'd tried God. And I didn't understand that the problem is that I needed more than just to throw a couple prayers into the air. I needed some what the old members of AA back in the 30s used to call soul surgery. I needed to remove from me the things that were blocking me from God. See, there's too much of me between me and God. Just as there was too much of me between me and you. Just as there's too much of me between me and life itself. That's why alcoholism is such a lonely business. When I stop drinking, I just get myself on me. Did you ever see that movie Alien where that creature attaches itself to your face? I get my emotions and my future and my worries and my remorse from my past, and I get all of me right there. And when it's like that, I feel like my very soul is suffocating. And it is. I am smothering me with me. And it always feels like somebody stepped on the oxygen hose to my being. That's why we all have the same experience. the first drink after 6 months. We all go, like somebody turned the air back on. Like my very being can breathe again. At the end, there was no relief. At the end, it was horrid. The year before I got sober, I'll tell you a little side story. I ended up one time in an emergency room. I stand up in emergency rooms quite often because I hurt myself. I'm pathetic, you know. Or sometimes in a drunken rage as the waves of remorse for what I did to my family and the women that love me, as that washes over me, I well up with such self-loathing that I'll put my fist through a window or something, and then I start bleeding, you know. I can't get it to stop. So I'm in the emergency room, and they've stitched me up, and they gave me some x-rays just to check, make sure I didn't break anything. And I'm sitting there. I've been in there for a couple hours, so I've kind of sobered up, because they don't give you nothing to drink in a hospital. So I'm kind of sobered up in there, and I'm sitting in the waiting room, waiting, got stitched up, waiting for the results of the x-rays to come back, and there's a rack of medical pamphlets there. You know, diabetes and heart disease and all that kind of stuff. And there's this one catches my attention for some reason, and it's the 7 warning signs of cancer. So I'm sort of sobered up quite a bit. I grab that pamphlet and I start paging through it, and I'm looking at it, and one of the warning signs was continued unexplained bleeding. When I'm reading that, I think, wait a minute. I dry heave sometimes and blood comes up. Oh, there are times when I'm bleeding out both ends. Oh my God, I got cancer. Oh, and it was a hard thought. And then there was like this little thought came into my mind. Wait a minute. It's metastasized into your brain. That's why you do these bizarre things and you can't remember them. That's why you go on these emotional roller coasters. That's why you flip out and go off the deep end with someone when they haven't done anything really and just flip out on them. That's why nobody likes you. That's why you can't hold a job. That's why you can't have relationships. You have a brain tumor. Oh my God, it explained volumes of my life. And I had this fantasy for some time about, you know, one of these days they're going to take me to the hospital and check me out, and they're going to find out. They're going to send me to the cancer ward, I suppose. And of course, they're going to have to notify my mother and father, who would have nothing to do with me because they thought I was a bum, and they're going to realize how wrong they'd been. Oh my God, Bob, you weren't a bum. You had a brain tumor. We didn't know. And they'd come running to the hospital, and then all my ex-girlfriends are going to be notified. They'll come running there properly ashamed of themselves. Oh, what a wonderful fantasy it was. I ended up in a treatment center second to last hospitalization. And this, I'm telling this doctor's checking me out, checking my vitals. I said, doc, I have a brain tumor. He looks at me kind of weird and he says, has this been verified? I said, yes, it has. Well, it's been verified by the smartest guy I know. I mean, you know. So he orders a whole gamut of tests where they shoot dye into you, all that kind of crazy stuff. He comes back to me a week or so later. He says, you don't have a brain tumor. You don't have any cancer at all. You have an ulcer and a hemorrhoid. And I was depressed. I kind of wanted a second opinion. I was Now, if you identify with that at all, you do not have a high mental health quotient. I'm so ego dominant that my ego would rather have me dead and you wrong and me right. That's pathetic. And I didn't know what I was in the grip of, and it was killing me. And I didn't know what it was. And I went on to my last run, and on that run, I tried to take my own life. This doctor who'd given me the complete workout said something to me that should have been good news, and it was hard to me. He said, you have alcoholism, and you keep drinking, it's going to kill you. When I was a young guy in my 20s, he said, well, you're young enough and you bounce back physically enough, quick enough, it might take 5 more years. I came to in the park on the north side of Pittsburgh, and I'd been thrown out of another place, and I was totally alone. And my drinking is pathetic, and I got the shakes. I'm only a day or two into this run, and I got the tremors like an old burnout wino. And I hate myself, and I can't get any relief in the bottle. And I'm dirty, and I don't even care. I smell, and I don't even care. I don't even care. I just start thinking how miserable I am, and I think about what that doctor said, 5 more years. And something snapped inside of me, and I thought, no, sir. And I made the decision to kill myself. I can't go 5 years. I can't even do 5 more days of this. And I'm in the place that it talks about where you can't imagine life with it, not like this. And I've done everything I can to roll it back to when it was fun and when there was some relief, and I can't, I failed. And I can't imagine life without it because I'm so depressed and lonely, sober. Abstinence feels like I'm doing time. And I've tried all the psychiatrists, all the medications. I've done all of it. And it only gives me a little bit of false hope and temporary relief, and I'm always back to being me again. And so I thought killing myself's a good way out. And I tell you, this sounds weird, but it's an honest to God truth. In the making the decision to kill myself, I started to feel better. I had this relief as if I'm gonna get this over with, right? And I went to this bridge to end it all. And I'm standing on this bridge, and about 100 feet or so below is a set of railroad tracks along the side of the river. And I'm looking down these railroad tracks and getting ready to leap, and this terror gripped me. And it's not a fear of dying. I'm not afraid of dying. I'd have drank myself to death if I could. It's just, it takes a long time drinking yourself to death. It's like being kicked to death by rabbits. It just goes on and on and on. That's why so many of us start thinking about offing ourselves, or we die, we just unconsciously do too much drugs, or unconsciously get too drunk and end up in a head-on collision. It's almost like a death wish because we just want to get this over with. And I couldn't jump. I just broke down and started sobbing for being so pathetic, because I'm afraid this isn't high enough. I'm afraid with my track record, and it's not like I've been a good luck magnet, with my track record, I'm going to screw this up like I've screwed everything else in my life up, and I'm not going to die. I'm going to end up paralyzed from the neck down in some charity ward, and I'm a young guy. I'll probably lay there sober, can't get a drink for 50 years, listening to my head work me over and tell me what a worthless piece of crap I am, as members of AA parade their newcomers through the room, and I get to hear them say, "Well, this is what happens to you when you don't work our wonderful 12 steps." And I'm paralyzed. I can't even give them the one finger salute. The book says that before you ever believe in AA, you get to a place where you'll believe in the hopelessness and futility of your life as you'd been living it. And it says then, and I think only then, when you're approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, the old timers in AA, it says you find yourself in a place where there's nothing left. Nothing left. There's no friendly direction anywhere. There's no hope in the bag and the bottle. There's no hope in changing towns and some new medication, some new therapy. You've tried it all, and there's nothing left except to pick up this simple kit of spiritual tools that doesn't make any sense. I've talked to thousands of guys and gals in AA. I've been doing hospital and institution stuff and meetings and detox twice a week now for 35 years almost at the end of this month. I've done it from day I got out of detox. I've been hammering these, being in the trenches. I've never met an alcoholic yet. In the throes of the hopelessness of alcoholism, you've just burnt your life to the ground and you're in a deep, horrid depression and self-loathing. I don't know anyone that's ever been in that place that looked at the 12 steps and went, Oh, yeah, that would work, yeah. Oh, I get to write stuff? And, oh, I spend the rest of my life paying back the money. This is going to be fun. Me and God, just like this, always have been, always will. It's good. Nobody says that. Matter of fact, you don't know that the steps work until after you do them. So if you're new, do them. Get a sponsor. I hope you're beaten enough and demoralized enough that you'll let other people here that have found a way out of the trap you're in to direct your life. I'm telling you, there's nothing here that will hurt you except you. Except you. When I was brand new, a guy, Joe Wright, cornered me. And he said to me, I was after this meeting, he said, kid, you need to take step three. I said, listen, Joe, I can't take step three. The truth is, I don't know if there's a God or not. I'm not as uptight about it as I used to be, but I don't really believe in God. I don't know if there's a God. And he said, you don't have to believe in God to take step three. I said, well, hey, Joe, that's kind of what it says. I mean, step two, I was looking right at the wall. It says, came to believe. And then it says, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I don't believe. I don't understand. I don't have any of this, Joe. He says, trust me. If you'll turn, you don't have to believe in God to take step three. I must be looking at him like he's crazy. He says, trust me. Turn your will and your life over to this chair. And he points to a chair in the Alano Club. He says, I guarantee you an instantaneous miracle. All right, Joe, I turn my will and my life over to the chair. What's the miracle? And he says, oh, the miracle would be your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. And I didn't get mad. I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Yeah. I get it. All right. I get it. See, if you'd have followed me around and watched me the last couple years, maybe as your friends and family and lovers have watched you, could they come to any conclusion other than whoever's making decisions for Bob is out to kill him? And yet, if you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, a mind that just chatters at you all the time, a mind that won't leave you alone, it's a mind that is based and strong in self-justification and rationalization. It'll tell you stories, so it's never really you, is it? If she would have understood, if they would have cut me a break, why were they so mean? Why was that judge like that? It's never you. And yet, from the time I was 12 years old, I started getting in trouble, and I was in trouble intermittently a lot until the time I got sober. And even in early sobriety, I was in trouble because I get sober. You don't think quitting drinking is the end of bright ideas, do you? Matter of fact, the longer I'm sober, the more I realize how much I need a sponsor. This gets smarter, doesn't it? It learns. It'll learn the traditions. It'll learn passages out of the book, and it'll use it to your own self-gratification or own self-aggrandizement. It'll take the traditions. And if you're like me, I went through a period where I just learned the steps in the book and the traditions so I could go to meetings and see how people really didn't have recovery like I did. I go look for tradition breaks. God, when you're an egomaniac and you've studied the traditions and you go to a meeting and somebody breaks them, it's like Christmas. Dr. Harry Tebow, who was the therapist Bill Wilson went to during his depression, and he's spoken at one of our international conventions. He's quoted in a lot of our literature. He talks about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. I'm watching a lot of men and women who are sober a long time go out, and some of them take their own lives with 20, 30 years of sobriety, and they don't know what's happening to them. They think that now, all of a sudden, they've developed a mental illness. Alcoholism's the great shift changer. They don't know that they are in the bondage of self. They think they're clinically depressed. They think that life hasn't treated them right. They think that AA's changed. I don't want to do that stuff anymore. It's not like it was in the old days. This is the old days, right here. This is the best it's ever going to get. And I am the guy who has to step up today. And it's all because of this ego. It just chatters at you, doesn't it? It just talks to you. It's so seductive. It's a lot. Its voice is much more reasonable than my mean sponsors. This voice promises fun. This voice promises things that'll make you feel good. This voice really cares about me. The best way to become sponsorable is don't be sponsorable for a long period of time. The ego comes back, and it comes back smarter and stronger. It's a hideous mechanism. I think one of the most frightening things I do in Alcoholics Anonymous is this. And in order to do this, I have to do a lot. I know guys in AA that this is all they do. That is frightening to me. That is frightening. I have a sponsor. Some of you have met him. He's been kind to me lately, but I think it's because he's getting old. But he's not known for kindness. He's known for abruptness and getting right to the point. And my sponsor is a guy named Clancy, who I've come to respect, and I love him very much. I trust him because I see your friends, they love you. Your friends, if they care a lot about you, they'll start sounding like your head. My sponsor never sounds like my head. And I need that in my life. I don't want to be a loose cannon. I want to be the guy. There comes a point, if you're very lucky, when peace and usefulness become more important than anything else. When unity becomes the most important. Unity between me and you and me and God. It's more important than gratification. It's more important than material success. And I've had a lot of all of that. One of the hardest things I've had to do in sobriety was to survive an outrageous amount of material success. And it's a dangerous. Chuck Chamberlain, who was my grand sponsor, used to say there's only one thing worse for an alcoholic than bad fortune, and that's good fortune. In the 12x12, it says, we drink of success as it were a wine that never fails to elate us, that causes us to dream bigger dreams of success, and leads to big shotism. There was a time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm embarrassed to tell you this, but it's the truth and it's pathetic. When I had done a lot of service, I'd been involved in a lot of conferences, I'd been high up in general service, I'd spent 9 years in general service, a lot of intergroup stuff, a lot of H&I, it was like I created in my mind, my ego created an imaginary AA resume that I would lord over people. Or I wouldn't, maybe. Maybe because my ego wants the bragging rights of a humble person. I don't tell you about it, but I just sit there as you're sharing and saying things I don't agree with, and look at my resume. Look at you. And I did. How isn't it pathetic that my ego could take the very spiritual principles and actions of Alcoholics Anonymous and use them to feed it? But my ego there's no end to its hypocrisy. It will use anything. It is like a hungry, insatiable dog. The more you feed it, the hungrier it gets. And so I live a lifestyle that's designed to save Bob from Bob. I'm in the trenches a lot. I sponsor guys. I listen to Fifth Steps. I don't do all of that so I can tell you. I do all of that because it's the only thing I can do to keep me somewhat right-sized. I go into some skid row places every week where they don't care that I'm sober a long time. they don't care that I've done a lot of things in AA. They don't care that I spoke out of town. I'm the guy that's interfering with their nap, right? And that is really good for me. I mean, I got a sponsor that doesn't care about any, oh man. And I love the way he sponsors me because I never know what he's gonna do. So I never have to say, oh, I don't have to call him, I know what he's gonna say. He surprises me continually. There have been times when I've just done something very, very wonderful. And I go to him to get an attaboy, to get, you know, cut my legs out from under me. And then there are other times when I've just done something I'm ashamed of. Oh, I don't want him to know I did this. I shouldn't have done it. Oh, I kind of knew better, but I was wrapped up in it in the moment. Shouldn't have done that. And I go to him just thinking he's going to just rake me over the coals, and he's so kind at those moments and so loving and understanding. He surprises me continually. You see, when I'm messed up and I try to look at myself to see what's wrong, I can't, because what I'm looking for, I'm looking with. But he sees me in objectivity against the background of the spiritual principles of self-reduction and service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he sees me very clearly. And I need that in my life. I will never really be able to run my own show here. And some people don't like that. I love it. I said to my sponsor many years ago, I said, listen, I'm going to do everything you tell me to do. But if you screw me up, I'm going to go around AA and tell everybody about you. And he started laughing. And his advice and his vision of Bob's life has always been better than mine, just like God's vision of Bob's life is better than Bob's vision. If you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if you've related to anything I've said tonight. I don't know. There are people here who come to AA that just have a drinking problem. And they just stop drinking. And they don't understand all this hoopla about the steps. And so, I mean, it's nice. It's altruistic. I mean, it's nice stuff. But they don't have the thing happen to them inside them when they quit drinking. That takes guys like me and slowly, incrementally, starts cooking me in my own emotional juices until I go so insane one day that picking up a drink seems like a good idea. And the day before, I would have sworn to you, I'll never drink again. Do you know, as I go to the detox and I talk to people that were 10, 15, 20, 30 years sober, drank again, that a week before they drank again, they would have bet anything they'd never drink again. They didn't know. The only way you can tell how you're doing is to check your feet. That's all. And my sponsor checks my actions continually. He really cares very little about how I feel. But he cares what I'm doing. And I like that. There's a tremendous security in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. I don't have to be perfect here. I don't even have to get good here. I'm not. All I have to do is stay in the game and continue to take these actions. Some days better than others. And if I stay in the game and I trust God, clean house, help others, make helping other people my primary purpose, and try to walk away from me being my primary purpose. If I do all that, I can spend a lifetime here. And it's an amazing security knowing that I need to know that Alcoholics Anonymous will work, not just to keep me physically sober, but it's got to be able to keep me free. And I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you all for listening.
Okay, I'd like to thank Bob for speaking with us tonight. That was wonderful. We're going to pass some baskets now. If you want to contribute, you can. If you don't, that's fine too. It is a free event. There's no registration for this event. But we are passing some baskets. So there you go. Once again, just to remind you, a recording of tonight's talk is available free on our website, simpleactions.net. I just want to go over the schedule tomorrow. We start off at 9:30 a.m. in the morning. And I know that's going to be rough for some people. But basically, there's two workshops in the morning, one at 9:30, one at 11. And then there's a potluck lunch. Feel free to bring a dish to share. And then at 1:30, and again at 3 o'clock, there's two workshops in the afternoon. And that'll wrap up the day tomorrow. There's some of these flyers up at the back. The other thing I wanted to let you guys know is there's AA literature available on a table up at the back there. If you want to purchase a big book, you can see Catherine. There's some newcomer packets there as well. There's also some meeting lists. So if you're interested in any of that, just see one of the people up at the back. So I think that's about it. So I look forward to seeing everybody who's coming tomorrow morning, bright and early at 9:30. And for those that care to join me, we're going to form a circle and say the Lord's Prayer. Thank you. I didn't want to put it in there, but they can grab it.